Should be fun. Pretty excited about this. This will be River City Sounds History Episode 3. I am Cole. We have with us
Brianna
and Zach.
So we're gonna do an episode about aerial tragedies involving musicians. I have big four for you guys here. I'm gonna tell you some detailed stories about the incidents in question. And I know that we also have some other incidences that we have lined up that may not be as involved or, more than a Wikipedia page information, or maybe they actually have a little bit of similarities that aren't as. Anyways, wait.
We should probably get into why we're doing this.
Why are we doing this?
Halloween. It just happened. So we're going to get spooky with it, talk about some darker stuff. It's a history podcast, so we'll stick to history, but macabre history.
And then also, I'm going to work backwards from my big four, and I was going to kind of rely on you guys to fill in with some other places as well as we move backwards. Do you guys have the dates for yours already kind of lined up and whatnot?
Geez, 60 something.
60 something. All
right. I want to say 65? 63.
Okay. And Zach, what you got bringing to the table? You want to surprise us or,
I think I got some extra details on what the stuff you're talking about.
Okay, very cool. So the first one is actually going to change our entire title. It's actually going to be Aerial Tragedies and Cliff Burton, because this first one's not really an aerial tragedy. I didn't realize until about halfway through writing it. But I feel like it had a lot of thematic elements that pertain to some other incidences of the Big Four that I'm going to mention. Ooh, I've been listening to The Dollop since I first wrote this. September 27th, 1986!
For the fans.
Yes. In the midst of Damage Inc. tour supporting the newly released Master of Puppets, Metallica was in between shows in Sweden when the discomfort of the tour bus beds got the best of bassist Cliff Burton. Lead guitarist Kirk Hamlett and Cliff Burton decided to draw playing cards to decide who would get the perfect preferred bunk that night. After pulling the Ace of Spades, Cliff Burton won the choice bunk, taking Kirk's usual spot for the night in the back next to the window. Dun, dun, dun. Kirk resigned to sleeping in the front that night, infamously noting that it was probably better up there anyways. Around 7 a.m. on the morning of September 27th, the bus lost control and flipped off the side of the road. The sleeping Cliff Burton was thrown for the bunk through the window, where the tour bus fell on top and crushed him. Oh, fuck, I forgot we should have done a little bit of warning. I'm in. I'm gonna get a little
We can
detail.
interject.
We can interject.
Do that at the end.
Little
What is the
stars. There was a conflicting accounts as to if the bassist died on the first crush or the second, when the crane brought to try and rescue the musician slipped on the and the tour bus fell on him again.
I don't think a second one's gonna do a lot more harm than a first one. Not to get really into it, but I'm no forensics person, but
There were also conflicting accounts as to what actually caused the accident. While the bus driver claimed to have lost control after hitting a patch of black ice, both a naked James Hetfield, who had first searched the area, and the local authorities both claimed that there was no such black ice on the road. Furthermore, it was noted that it was 2 degrees above freezing and therefore unlikely to have any ice.
Unlikely.
While James Hetfield blames the
Unlikely.
driver, insinuating that he was intoxicated during the time of the incident, a
Likely.
detective was noted as saying that the crash site's tire tracks were indicative of incidents where drivers fall asleep at the wheel. The driver
Yes.
was determined to not be at fault, and no charges were ever brought against him. So yes, as I said, even though it's not an aerial tragedy, we're going to a little bit light. This will also kind of come into some other elements. I think with the next one, as well as the last one we do. So we're going to go from 80s.
Before
Yes.
we get into it, they never did any sort of toxicology on this dude? Like, he didn't do
I don't think so.
The
breathalyzer,
driver.
anything?
Yeah, you'd think.
You would think. I don't have that. If I.
People died.
I feel like I should have noted that specifically, but
I
I
feel like if
didn't.
it were going to be there, you would have. It tells me they did not.
Tells me they did not. Again, this is also Sweden, too.
And they're
It's
rich.
not.
Oh, true.
I don't know specifically what their laws are against drunk driving over there
I'm
or
sure they
whatnot.
have them.
They probably do. I mean, like when we're in Barbados, you could drink and drive. They had someone like drinking a rum and coke and just speeding like 25 miles over the 50 mile an hour speed limit down the curves. It was sweet.
All right.
Do we have any incidents between 86 and 82?
Mm-mm, I got one at
Okay.
63.
All right. Anything you want to add in here, Zachary?
You know, Zachary? I was wondering, was the window open?
No, I don't think so. Because it was supposed to be like really cold outside.
Yeah, right. So, if the bus...
I'm thinking it has to be a big-ass window.
Big window.
Like a body length, short window like you see on the top of one of those things.
It's a tour bus.
It's a tour bus. And it's an old tour bus. Huge windows. They got photos of it. They're, you know...
Look at the picture.
We could.
Yeah.
Let's see what the tour bus looked like.
It looked more like a Greyhound than you would think a tour bus these days.
Yeah.
A tour bus these days has got like a few windows in the front, and all the bunks have no windows.
Probably because it's, you know, safer if you get into a crash like that. Maybe while you're looking up, I could do the warning real quick.
Sure.
Warning. This episode is going to have some probably violent discussions.
Holy shit, that's cool as fuck.
We'll be discussing aerial disasters and other disasters.
One bus crash.
But yeah, this is just a warning for those who are not comfortable with those types of details. We're going to try and keep it mostly light and breezy, but...
If you want to come over here and look at this...
Oh yeah, I'm looking at it.
Here's this all opened up on the side, but in here's on the other side is how big these fucking windows were.
They're about the size of a regular house window.
Can you see it, Zach?
Yeah.
That one's all opened up.
Yeah, I was looking earlier. Yeah, it's like a big front, big pane window in your living room kind of a thing.
Yeah, but like three of them or four of them right next to each other in a line.
So the bus falls over, starts sliding, all the windows shatter, and then who knows what after that.
Yeah.
Somehow he ended up under it.
That's the other thing, too, is that these stories, at least the big four, I'm saying, are going to be a little bit more involved as we go on.
Oh, yeah.
The next one... Oops, I... Oh, this is not a touchscreen computer anymore, is it? I've had this computer for years and I still don't remember. March 18th, 1982. On the night of March 18th, after playing a show in Knoxville, Tennessee, Ozzy Osbourne and his band drove most of the night to their next stop in Orlando, where they made an unscheduled stop in Leesburg, Florida to fix a broken air conditioner unit that was on the bus. There'll be another... thing. Shitty tour buses, shitty planes. Yep. It's gonna keep happening.
An unexpected stop in Florida?
That's not a good stop.
Red flag.
Red flags. While waiting for repairs, bus driver Andrew Acock, this is getting a little confusing here because there's a lot of people involved in getting off and on the plane because there's two trips. The bus driver decides to take the musicians on a quick joyride around the property. On two separate flights, Acock took members of the band up in the air in early 1950s Beechcraft Bonanza. That is also another infamous plane that has killed a lot of musicians as well. The tour bus driver would proceed to quote-unquote buzz the tour bus, where it was confirmed that Ozzy and the drummer Tony Aldridge were still sleeping. On the first flight, Acock took the tour manager Jake Duncan and the keyboardist Don Airey up and successfully, quote-unquote, buzzed the bus in an attempt to wake up the sleeping touring musicians. While guitar player Randy Rhodes was known to have a fear of flying, he initially wanted to go up and take aerial photos for his mother, but the antics of the first flight may have given him some reason to stay grounded. Randy saw makeup artist and seamstress Rachel Youngblood boarding for the second flight. Rhodes was worried about Rachel's known heart condition, but after being assured by Acock that he would take it easy and only circle the property a few times, Randy decided to go up and take those aerial shots. Unfortunately, Acock would continue his aerial acrobatics, and within 5 minutes, the small plane has buzzed the tour bus two more times, coming in for a third.
Jeez.
The incident was seen on the ground by Don Airey, keyboards, who was then taking pictures of Randy's flight with his own camera on the ground at the time to, again, give to his mother. Through the telephoto lens, he could see directly into the cockpit where Airey reported to have been seen a struggle happening on board between Acock and Rhodes. The wings began to tip from side to side before tilting and flying perpendicular while descending just over 2 meters off the ground. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Airey says he put his camera down to see the plane coming right directly towards him. Don crouched down to avoid the plane, watching it as it screamed over top of him and over his shoulder, saw it make contact with the bus. At approximately 10 a.m., the wing of the Beechcraft Bonanza clipped the top of the tour bus with its initial impact. Both 25-year-old Randy Rhodes and 58-year-old Rachel Youngblood had their heads crashed through the plane's window shield. The plane continued onward, severing the top of the nearby tree before nosediving into the garage nearby mansion, where it immediately burst into flames. While Ozzy recalled being woken up and screamed for everyone to get off the bus, Sharon maintains, which we'll believe Sharon, that she was already off the bus screamed for and escorting others off the bus by the time Ozzy had come out. It's not really important on why I added that. While most of the people who were in the immediate area were too shocked to approach the fire and the emergency vehicles were a while off, in a full-hearted attempt, drummer Tony Aldridge would rush to the plane in a vain attempt to smother the flames with the tour bus fire extinguisher.
Oh, that's not going to be enough.
No. Mm-hmm. While all three bodies were burnt beyond recognition, Randy Rhodes would be identified by dental records and identifying jewelry. According to Sharon Osborne, the rest of the three of them had to be dismembered and there were just body parts everywhere. Tour manager Jake Duncan, who had been on the first flight, was found outside on the ground, rocking back and forth, screaming over and over, "They're gone. They're gone." Duncan later detailed that Aycock's behavior on the first flight was concerning, but he felt there was no sense of foreboding.
Now, when they say buzz the top of the bus,
he's going really close and just
flying over,
like
it.
The vibrations, trying to wake up everybody,
trying to touch it.
No, just
trying
get really
close.
Trying to stay
as close as you can without touching it.
Yeah.
Okay.
A flyby.
And the tour manager didn't see a problem with that.
Guess not.
I think
with his employee, the driver. Yeah.
I think it'll be a theme of managers making bad decisions here.
Yeah.
Or just failing to act.
Mm-hmm.
Managers and drivers and other professionals.
Supposed professionals.
I mean, this is Ozzy Osbourne in 86. Mm-hmm. Like, this is also, you got to remember, this is, have you seen, what is it, The Dirt, I think, on Netflix? Mm-hmm. Where, no, that's the one with, I think it's Machine Gun Kelly plays Tommy Rowe. It's about Motley Crue.
Oh.
And there's a little short bit where they're on tour with Ozzy, and there's the scene, they all combine into one scene where they lick, snort ants off the thing, lick each other's piss, and...
Just
being wild.
Boys being
it's,
boys.
It's Ozzy. Okay, so tour bus driver Andrew Aycock, who was flying at the craft at the time, was found to have had trace amounts of cocaine in his system. In addition to flying with an expired pilot's license, the plane also had been taken without permission.
Makes sense.
Randy Rhodes, not known for indulging in the late night parties that the other members enjoyed, usually spent his downtime practicing over the infamous debauchery of the Osborne Band. Rhodes himself was only found to have had nicotine in his system at the time of the event.
Wanted to take some pictures.
Apparently, when the news broke, it wasn't told who it was, and Butler Geisler, Adler, bassist for Black Sabbath, actually called to make sure that it wasn't Ozzy who had died. Now, there aren't really, like, confirmed, I don't know, incidences. I haven't seen anyone suggest this, but seeing that one instance where the guy said he saw them struggling after the third attempt makes me think that Youngblood had an episode, more than likely, and it was Randy Rhodes trying to correct it, or maybe he also felt, I don't know, had another
kind of episode.
Yeah.
What do you mean by episode?
Because she had a heart condition.
Oh, she did have a heart condition.
And that's why the only reason he got on, people believe, was because he was told it would be taken easy because of her heart condition. Which he did not.
He did not. And it only got worse from there.
Yes. So again, the addition of the tour bus and the Beechcraft Bonanza. So that's another little thing there as well.
Beechcraft is coming back.
We're going to move on to 77. Do we have anything in between there you guys like to pop in? Because I know some of the older ones are kind of before that, like the day the music died and like somewhere around the time
of Patsy
Cline and whatnot. All right, so we are going to go back up to the future here in August 27th, 1990. Stevie Ray Vaughan will die in a helicopter crash. I don't have too much information on this because it's just one of those incidents where got on the plane, took off, just went down. Not a whole lot of exhibition before that. Everyone who would die would be the helicopter pilot, his road agent, his bodyguard, tour manager, and Stevie Ray Vaughan himself. No members of the band. I'm not a huge Stevie Ray Vaughan fan, but he's one of those guys who, like, I see on Instagram, and it's like, yeah, you know, he's It's Jimi Hendrix, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and then now it's John Mayer, unfortunately. as the descendants of who plays the songs, I guess. Are you a big Stevie Ray Vaughan fan at all?
I've spun his first, I think his, or not his first, but his the major like live album that he has. I mean, it's pretty nasty. It's pretty nasty.
I mean, yeah, it's the thing. Yeah, I don't know. It's he carries on the flame of Jimi Hendrix in some ways. Yeah. Like he'll play, what is it, Voodoo Child and like Little Wing, some of the really big ones.
It's just that super aggressive like blues. That's, I mean, Jimi Hendrix kind of did that too.
Yeah, I mean,
aggressive picking.
And I mean, that's like, what it was. He was the, you know. It, almost in the same way that ELO tried to carry on for where the Beatles left off, quote unquote. I felt that was a similar thing there. And same thing with John Mayer when Stevie Ray Vaughan tried, but you know, whatever. The songwriting gets progressively worse.
He's a good guitar player.
He's a good guitar player, yeah. That's just one of those things. It took me a while to even appreciate Jimi Hendrix guitar playing on.
Really?
Not guitar playing, his songwriting, excuse me.
Yeah.
But no, guitar playing, absolutely. Our next one is going to be, I don't want to say my favorite because it's kind of gruesome, but this one will be pretty nasty. October 20th, 1977. Within the first few days of the tour of the Survivors, backup singer Casey Gaines had become increasingly fearful of the nearly 30-year-old Convair CV-420 aircraft that the band had been using for their previous tour. I didn't say who I was talking about, did I?
Not yet.
No. While the equipment tour bus that she might have ridden on already left, Cassie tried to convince the rest of Lynyrd Skynyrd to charter a commercial flight to their next big show in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. No? Okay. The question of the plane's stability wandered its way through the group that afternoon, but any thoughts to the contrary were squashed by then-singer Ronnie Van Zant, who declared, "If you're not at that show, you're fired."
I feel like if every one of the band, except for one person, is going, "Is this safe to ride on?"
It's the mid 70s. He's the quote band leader, and he's a man.
God.
I think I'm just gonna go with that explanation. You gotta think, they're all from Florida, and like their main imagery is like the rebel flag. Even though they're not like Confederate, they still like really much harbor that shit, which is very unfortunate.
Because
I fucking love Lynyrd Skynyrd so much. Anyways. Just don't, you know, just don't hang any of their posters. At 4 p.m. on October 20th, 1977, 24 passengers and two crew members boarded the Convair with what should have been 900 gallons of fuel, enough for 5 hours of flight time. A little foreshadowing there. 2 hours and 40 minutes into the flight, some of the passengers became aware that something might be terribly wrong. Unbeknownst to the band, pilot Walter McCreary and co-pilot William Gray had just contacted Air Traffic Control Center in Houston, Texas, to request a nearest airport. After confirming that something was indeed wrong, the pilot belayed that they were running out of fuel fast. Drummer Artemis Pyle recalls entering the cockpit only to find two very frightened co-pilots who told him to go back and make sure everyone was strapped in. Despite... yeah, it gets heavy really
not
quick.
Not what you want to hear.
It gets heavy quick. All right. Despite only a mere five estimated minutes away from their destination, the decision was to make a 180-degree turn in an attempt to reach a near, smaller Macomb airport. It was barely over a minute after the plane had made a successful U-turn that the pilot Walter McCreary stated to Houston that they had ran out of fuel before he listed off the plane's license plate number. The last thing McCreary did before radio silence confirmed the plane's altitude of 4,500 feet.
I feel I'm Damn. No pilot or like engineer, but
quick.
I feel like making a 180-degree turn would burn more fuel,
maybe,
than just and coasting.
There are
and
a lot
altitude
of
altitude for sure.
So this one I got a lot of references from. My dad has a. Yeah. I don't know if I actually wrote down the references for this one at the end of it. No, I didn't. My dad has a book about the whole history of it, and there's a full chapter on it, which I will mention because we'll get to it. As the engines died, the interior of the plane fell silent, with only the sounds of the wind rushing and slowly slowing up the turbines just before they finally stopped. The silence hung and suspended in the air for a moment, and then 21,000-pound aircraft fell from the sky, only to be broken by the sound of what guitar player Gary Gossington described as hundreds of baseball bats hitting the underside of the plane. While the 5-degree angle held by the pilot should have been sufficient for a crash landing, the crucial decision to turn around had placed them right over top a swamp-infested woods. Ah. Yeah.
Trees.
Yes, trees. The CV-24 finally hit the tree line. The initial impact of the airliner ripped every single seat out from the floor, causing the entire occupancy to be thrown against the internal panels of the plane as the craft began to be shredded apart. Lead singer and founder Ronnie Van Zant, who was said to have been sleeping on either the floor or in his seat without a seatbelt, was thrown from his seat so violently that the keyboard player, Billy Powell, believed him to have died when he watched the singer hit a tree while being flung from the aircraft. While other reports state that upon the initial impact, Ronnie had been at the bottom of a nearly 20-person pile of bodies that had been thrown into the plane's interior walls, along with guitar player Steve Gaines and assistant road manager Dean Kilpatrick, all three of which died of apparent head wounds upon the initial crash, also sustained broken bones in their lower legs as well. Of the surviving front seat passengers, founding member and guitarist Alan Collins had received a cervical spine injury and almost completely lost the use of his right arm. Guitar player Gary Gossington had broken both of his arms, his pelvis, and his right leg, while sound engineer Kevin Ellison suffered from a collapsed lung, and his left arm was the only limb that did not sustain any broken bones.
Only his left arm did not.
So he was fucked up. That's the other thing, too, is that if you start going into this, there's a lot of fucking people. Like, they really do travel in a fucking pack. Mm-hmm. Like I said, 24 of them, and that's like, half of that's the band. You know what I mean? So what's the other half? Because, actually, we'll get into that, because I think there was kids who didn't get on the plane. Mm-hmm. Well, the modified front passenger section where Van Zant, Gaines, and Kilpatrick had been seated had been flipped and torn apart in the center section of the plane. Only one more member of the band would lose their life. Backup singer and older sister of Steve, Casey Gaines, would also die of head and neck injuries, more than likely when she was thrown from her seat. Additionally, backup singer Leslie Hawkins was sitting across from the aisle from Casey, also received cervical spine injuries and deep facial lacerations. Bassist Leon Wilkinson had broken both his left arm and leg, while a chest wound caused internal injuries that stopped his heart twice before being revived by doctors. Keyboard player Billy Powell had severe lacerations on his face so deep that almost completely severed his nose. Oof. Bodyguard and author Gene Ordum, this is the guy who wrote the book, all right, was thrown from the hole created from the fuselage where he broke his neck, additionally being the only person to have been burned in the incident. While the story famously goes that the right engine had caught on fire upon going down, there was no such fire, and the burns Ogden sustained were from phosphorus of the de-icing flares liquefied his eye.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot of weird shit happened because there's no fuel in the lodge for it to catch fire.
Yeah, I was about to say something.
Yeah. While most of the survivors were badly injured, the majority of them had been seated in the center of the rear section of the plane. Backup singer Leslie Hawkins and crewman Bill Sykes had buckled into their seats and were suspended in the trees by a precarious piece of roof that had somehow managed to stay intact. One of the less injured, drummer Artemis Pyle,
was a less injured person?
Yes, the drummer, Artemis Pyle, had torn his chest cartilage and, with broken ribs sticking out of his torso, was able to climb from the wreckage and wade several hundred yards through the deep swamp to find help. Luckily for the band, a number of local farmers in the area had actually watched the descending aircraft sputter and wobble into the air before making a crucial U-turn that landed them in the trees. I told you this one's getting pretty long. While emergency response vehicles were still a little bit ways off, locals took to their trucks and work vehicles and sped towards the crash site. While simultaneously wading through a 20-foot wide, waist-deep creek and overgrown forest to reach the site, locals assisted officials in transporting the injured to different local hospitals in the back seats of their car. Some returned home from their tractors to help remove rubble or stuck rescue vehicles, or even helped to coordinate the rescue efforts on their CB radios.
Shout out to the locals.
Yeah, I know, right?
Always helpful.
One local is going to get a little bad.
Oh, no.
One local, Don Chase, was the first to arrive on the site, personally carrying victims from the wreckage. Upon exiting the wreckage, Chase recalls watching as one or more onlookers stood by, only too content to watch. Disgusted? What the fuck does that mean? Oh, disgusted. I just spelled that wrong. Disgusted by this blatant display of bystander effect, pulled one of the rubberneckers in the water by his neck and shirt, and with the onlookers came what the National Guard called bone pickers. Yeah, sometimes when I'm reading stuff, I don't know if it's, I'm just regurgitating it, and I don't actually like hear what I'm saying sometimes. That's why I have to ask, like, does that make sense?
Who are the bone pickers?
Before they could secure the area under the cover of darkness and confusion, it was said that that souvenir sneakers removed wallets, jewelry, cash, and even pieces of wreckage such as seats, seat belts, and pillows. Security guard Gene Obden said that he was stripped of his wallet, watch, ring, and all the cash while he lay lying on the ground.
Jesus.
Bone pickers. In the end, in addition to singer Ronnie Van Zant, additional assistant road manager Dean Kilpatrick, guitarist Stephen Gaines, and his elder sister and backup singer Casey Gaines, both the pilot and co-pilot Walter McCready and William McRae, were killed in the crash. And yes, seriously, like they say in the last podcast, why true crime now? True crime always. It was so bad back then. We just listened to, yes.
Oh, finish your thought.
I was going to say we listened to the one about the bath incident and just the people who came and would park, who would, like, what, pay the top dollar to park closest to the house who had lost the most children.
Yeah, that was
and
the
thing
line.
And something like that. Like, it's been worse than it has been now.
I was just wondering if you had an exact number because I don't think I heard it. Out of, I think you said 24 people on the plane, how many survived?
I don't think I have. Oh, I actually might have it like written down because I have like I might have read this paper.
Because you have the one security guard author. He's the only one I like know in my head.
So, four people died, and then six people died.
Okay,
that's all six. And then I think it was 24 passengers, two crew members. So, yeah, 20 people lived.
Okay,
and
wow.
Six people died.
Seriously,
that is actually way later than I thought it was. They all were maimed and injured for life. They probably have a lot of difficulties nowadays, but they're alive.
Yeah. This is going to be interesting here. Aerosmith inspects and rejects both aircraft and crew in 1977 for their own tour, the same crew and aircraft. Quote, fuel gauge in older model planes were known to malfunction and the pilots had neglected to check the tanks manually. Although no mechanical or electrical discrepancies were found during the examination of the right magneto during the pre-flight inspection, if you remember, that was the one they were talking about, they said might have caught fire.
Yeah.
The right engine malfunctioned under an undeterminate nature. Billy Sykes noticed that the right engine was smoking upon takeoff.
Takeoff?
Yes, upon takeoff.
Wow.
Man, why did I just
write leaking something for hours.
Smoking.
Another reason might have been the plane sat on the runway burning fuel as the band waited on a limousine transport from them to the airport. So after they had, that's pretty self-explanatory.
After they had filled it up and then not checked how much fuel was in it and then sat on the runway, and also the engine was possibly burning more fuel than usual, they ran out of fuel. Oh, so, and the gauges were
stuck.
So
that was the other thing, too. There's a thing about auto lean versus auto rich.
Okay.
I had to look that up, and
it's
a
fuel mixture thing.
It's the fuel mixture thing about like how much air is in it or whatnot, and they flipped it to the wrong one, so they're wasting more fuel in the wrong section. That might have been our reason. There's no actual like this is why, but there are a lot of incidents like this could have been it. This could have been it. This could have been it. So, although toxicology reports that neither pilot had been impaired during the time of the incident, Gene Obden and Wikipedia both dispute this, saying that they were high on cocaine at the time, even though it is confirmed that they were clean. I did actually go in and correct Wikipedia.
Good on you for doing the work.
I sent them a thing. I was like, I read the book. He only suggests it. He does not actually go out and say they were doing cocaine. He says, what if they were doing cocaine, was the line.
Uh-huh.
It was a very...
Good on you.
Very specific.
Putting that history degree to work.
Thank you.
You did your job the degree had for you. Like...
So
that was the worst way to say it, but yeah.
So, the next one, the big one we're going to do is the last one. That takes place in 59, so I think we have a couple we can interject here in between. First off, in December 10th of 1967, Otis Redding.
Do it right.
What?
Like the dollop.
I didn't do the album like that. I only did the big one like that.
All right.
Okay. December 10th, 1967.
Thank you.
Otis Redding and four members of the Barkays and the valet and the pilot would die in another incident with a Beechcraft H-18, another Beechcraft incident. Again, not too much actual information behind it, and especially like the next one, Patsy Cline. It's just so...
She fits right
in. It's so similar to the next, to our last one, without more of the thematic elements that I'm trying to convey throughout it. Was that bad?
No.
Okay, just the way you're looking at me.
Makes sense to me.
I'm just saying is that there's more... It's, they're both so similar, but there's more to this next one.
Okay.
That's just me. But do you want to talk about Patsy Cline? I gave it away, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can do Patsy. To a wonderful woman, we have a great story about Patsy Cline's death. March 3rd, 1963. Cowboy Copas, Patsy Cline, and Hackshaw Hawkins and others performed at a benefit concert for the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall in Kansas City, Kansas. For the family of disc jockey Cactus Jack Call, he had died in an incident in December, actually, an automobile incident.
Oh, yeah.
So they were performing a memorial concert. Mm-hmm. Patsy was originally going to go accompany Dottie and Bill West in their station wagon back to Nashville, but had suddenly changed her mind. Mm-hmm. Mildred Keith, who took the last photo of Patsy before she died on that very stage, overheard Patsy after a phone conversation with her husband, Charlie Dick, crying on Dottie's shoulder about the fact that Mr. Dick had allegedly pressured her to get home in the quickest way possible. One of the children were ill, and he supposedly was tired of babysitting. Hmm. Babysitting his own children, of course. Mm-hmm. Dottie later confirmed in an interview that she was surprised and worried when Patsy informed her she would fly back to Nashville in a small airplane owned by Randy Hughes.
No, see, you're already putting in things I didn't know. So good job on your research.
That was what that look was for.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you. I have themes.
Themes.
I have coinciding themes. West expressed her alarm to Patsy, who brushed aside her concerns, saying philosophically, quote, "Don't worry about me, Hoss. When it's my time to go, it's my time."
Wait, I heard that. Remember that one.
It's a very famous line. Friends of Patsy later told that in weeks prior to her death, Patsy talked about a feeling of an impending sense of doom, mm-hmm. and she began giving away her personal items to friends and actually wrote a will on Delta Airlines stationery. She had told the Jordan Air singer Ray Walker, "Honey, I've had two bad accidents. The third one will either be a charm or it'll kill me." March 5th, 2 days later, after being grounded for inclement weather in the days before, Patsy Cline, Cowboy Copas, and Hackshaw Hawkins boarded a small plane in Kansas City, Kansas, to return to their homes in Nashville, Tennessee. Pilot Randy Hughes, first name Ramsey, Randy Hughes, successfully took off from Fairfax Municipal Airport and landed for 15 minutes to refuel at Rogers Municipal Airport that afternoon. At 5:05 p.m., Hughes landed at Drysburg Regional Airport, where he requested a weather briefing for the remainder of the flight to Nashville. I just want to put this in here to include... He landed and refueled and talked about the weather, and he did, mm-hmm. it seems like, all the right things. Mm.
Except get back in the air, basically.
Well, he got back in the air, yeah. I mean,
that's definitely what I'm saying. He shouldn't have got back in the air.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Because it was I don't know, it's very similar to the next thing, where it's just, like, shitty weather, and it's just, like, they shouldn't have gone up, they go up, mm-hmm. and then you see the plane disappear in the fog, and you never see it again.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. That's actually kind of formulaic.
I know. It's just so foreboding, because they have... I'll let you do it. I'm not going to steal your thunder. Sorry.
Hughes was informed that while the local weather was clear right now, closer to Nashville, he would lose visibility and need to rely on aviation instrument flight rules. And I think we should really talk about this because it'll probably play into some other bits here.
Yeah, please.
There's really two ways to fly a plane.
Yeah.
Visibility, you're looking outside the window as the pilot and, you know, you see things in front of you and you fly in those directions. The other way is through the instruments. Usually you do this when you cannot see and you need to fly.
Yeah, because you can do them both ways, but it's like the special thing of...
Generally combine them if you want to be a good pilot, I guess.
But there's like certain... Best of both worlds. You can't fly under certain conditions if you don't know how to do the... Right.
Yes, and...
The gear one.
Pilot Huge was not verified to fly using only instruments.
Another theme.
Mm-hmm. He had a pilot's license. It was valid. But he did not have that other certification to fly blind, essentially. So, Huge was actually Patsy Cline's manager and the son-in-law of Cowboy Copas, who was also on the plane. He was an overall inexperienced pilot, too. He only had 44 hours lodged on this specific plane, a Piper Comanche.
That's the other thing, too, is you need to log specific hours on certain kinds of planes, too.
He had a total of 160 hours, which I'm pretty sure is not great.
I think that also kind of plays in... Again, those are two really things that play into the next one.
I want to say the number is like 200, but I'm not 100% sure about that, so no quotes. Immediately before the crash, a witness reported hearing a low-flying craft increase in noise before seeing a white light descending at about a 45-degree angle. At about 6:29 p.m., 5 miles west of Camden, Tennessee, in a wooded, swampy area, the plane crashed, killing all occupants instantly. They think it went into a bit of a graveyard spiral, is the term I learned about.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Essentially, it happens when you can't see and you're relying mostly on, like, your own sense of direction, which doesn't work when you can't see. Like, you can't run in a straight line when you can't see. It's a fact. You will... curve and turn and go turning, the other direction.
Turning too much and turning the wrong way.
Yeah, you just can't do it.
That's what the theory is about that one Australian UFO sighting that dude died. You know what I'm talking about? Where he was supposed to fly, he didn't have the same thing. He didn't have panel instructions and he was flying at night and he thought there was a UFO above him and people think that
he was upside down
and he was seeing himself on the bottom and that the fuel... It's one of those planes that doesn't work upside down. The fuel didn't get in and just went in the water.
Oh wow, that's terrifying.
That is, wow.
So around 7 p.m. that night, Tennessee Highway Patrol did an initial search of the area and found nothing. A search party was organized, and about 6:10 a.m. the next morning, the wreckage was found. Like I said, the Federal Aviation Administration's investigation concluded that low visibility, Hughes' inexperience on flying based on those instruments, and really just him losing his orientation. He entered that graveyard spiral, and when he eventually could get some visibility, he was basically too late to stop.
Yeah.
And he just hit a tree and it was done. But yeah, there's a lot of memorials, I think, in that immediate area to Patsy Cline and Copas.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those.
And there is, I think, a museum nearby. But yeah, Rip to Patsy. A legend.
Thank you very much for contributing. I appreciate it a lot. That was a really good one.
Thank you. I did my research. I had a degree.
Yes, you did a great job. You also have a history degree. Even though it's art history, it's still a history degree.
Hey, this is art history. They're musicians.
Yeah, there we go. Our last one we're going to do, as obviously been hinted, it is The Day the Music Died. Yes, the American Pie, not the movie. But one thing I do want to bring up real quick is how much do we actually know, like maybe not us three, but we as collective, even the listeners, know Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, and Richie Valens?
Not that much. Buddy Holly more than Richie.
No.
Same.
Okay, so Richie Valens. This is what we're all going to know him for. Can you hear anything, Brianna?
I hear it, yeah. Okay, yeah.
La Bamba. La da da
bam bam. Yeah, I definitely know that one. I think they used to play a version of that at Ocean Breeze when I was a child.
Yeah, that's a pretty popular song to do. Big Bopper, not really a whole lot that we really know. He did some weird song about being a fucking wolf. Little Red Riding Hood, that was a really weird one, where he does like this weird skizz up.
Like scatting?
It's really weird. He just sings to this fucking like, what is that? Sorry, that's really loud.
It's a mannequin? Oh yeah, that's a fucking mannequin. That is not a woman.
Yeah, he's like singing to a fucking mannequin.
What the lengths theater will go to not include women.
What's up?
the lengths theater will go to not include women. Let's just put a mannequin in. It'll be fine. It's like a woman.
But yeah, Big Bopper, that was his thing. Of course, we should know the Crickets and Buddy Holly for "Every Day It's Getting Closer."
Yeah, yeah.
Rolling faster. What else does he do besides that? That's the other thing, too. Fucking type Buddy Holly, he's getting Weezer all the goddamn time.
Weezer's taking over Buddy Holly's life.
Just that Buddy Holly. Oh, that'll be the day? Well, that'll be the day that I sit up by my little... Oh, Peggy Sue. Okay, okay. Peggy Sue. Some of their songs that you might know from the Beatles doing covers of them back in the early 60s, late 50s. A lot of the early rock and roll stuff, even though he just was like the whitest nerd ever. It's so weird how these fucking people look. Because, God, did I write their ages? They were so fucking young when they died, too.
Yeah.
And if you look at pictures of like Richie Valens and them, they're like 19... 20 maybe. You saw that picture and video of them. Like, they're so young and weird looking. I don't understand how people back then just look so 70 years old when they're only like 20. It's ridiculous.
Buddy Holly was 22.
Yeah, and he was the oldest, wasn't he?
Ooh, I don't know.
I think the Valens was super young. I should have written it down. I didn't write it down.
Oh, Richie Valens was 17.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a baby.
Wow.
How old is the Big Bopper?
Big Bopper was 28.
20. Okay, so he was the oldest. But he at least...
Still looks young.
He looks like he's 50, dude. He could be 50.
Oh, wow. Like, yeah, he looks like a grandpa.
I don't understand why the 50s are just like this. That's weird.
Hard times.
And we thought that our generation of youngins grew up and looked adult young too quickly. Like, geez. So, sorry for that long exhibition. We're probably going to cut a decent amount of us just sitting there locked watching videos that you guys can hear. February 3rd, 1959. In November of 58, after his dissociation with the Crickets, Buddy Holly would schedule a winter dance party tour to recoup losses from the Crickets' thieving manager and to support his pregnant wife. Beginning late January of 1959, over a span of 21 days, the band had booked over 24 shows and added a new hit artist to the bill, Richie Valens, and J.P. Richardson, who went on to go to use the stage name, The Big Bopper, in addition to the vocal group Dion and the Belmonts. This is a big fucking tour, and there's a lot of people involved in this. Not really. Buddy Polly's new vocal backup group consisted of guitarist Tony Alsop, drummer Carl Butch, and Waylon Jennings on bass, not guitar. We know Waylon Jennings. He's, you know, country music star of the 70s and whatnot, but this is where he kind of gets his start from. And they would serve as the backing band for not only Holly, but all of the acts, and this is going to come into play as well. While the pure number of tour dates was stressful enough, the venues were scattered across the Midwest in a zigzagging pattern that made no logical sense. The organization that booked the tour, the General Artist Corporations, or GAC, had Holly recently signed with in the hopes of a future European tour. So he's doing this. It was like, you're going to Europe after this. So just do this shit. You get some money. Pay your pregnant wife. You can take care of her. Go to Europe after this.
What's so great about Europe?
This is the early 50s, though. So this was the time when rock and roll was coming to Europe. And then it was going to be like vice versa in like 10 years when the Beatles come over.
Okay.
And it's going to be like, you know, the British invasion and shit. Where it's like, all, you know, the Stones, the Beatles, all of them are like, America's where to hit it. So okay. This is like before that, when like a rock and roll's got to go hit Europe at the time, I think. Fair?
Yeah, that sounds right.
So this General Artist Corporations had failed to research the distance between venues or to take into consideration the direction in which the tour would move.
Supposed professionals.
No planning.
Hopefully you guys will take some notes to this if you guys are trying to do your tour for the first time. This is just like,
Listen, man, I'm not here to plan. I'm here to play a guitar.
They're here to plan, not that, whatever.
Step one, find out where the venue is.
Yeah.
Step two, find out where a good next venue is.
So instead of typically circling around the Midwest, the group would sporadically zigzag across the region, sometimes traveling as far as 400 miles a day between venues. A typical day for the musicians was traveling between 10 to 12 hours a day loading and unloading equipment by themselves in tour buses that would frequently break down and be repaired so frequently that completely replacing a bus was an every other day occurrence. Frostbite and flu.
Where are you getting these buses from?
We'll get into it. Frostbite and flu would work its way amongst the groups. Hospitalizing
1907.
Hospitalizing the drummer Carl Butch for frostbitten feet, not foot, feet, and leaving the band without a drummer for a period of time. This would leave each of the singers to fill in on drums for each other's acts. Holly would play for Dion. Dion would play for Richie, and Richie would play for Holly.
I just want to bring up. Flu going around sounds honestly a little bit worse than frostbite. Because imagine you have it 1 week, it's gone next week, the next week after that, you got it from fucking Richie.
I haven't
Valens.
Even told you how long this period of time has gone in R for yet. Because this is only supposed to take place in 21 days. I haven't told you how long this has gone.
It's probably like a week.
Maybe.
They probably hate each other by now, too. We're just like, I would fucking kill him if I saw him in an alley.
It was only 11 days into the tour, and they had already worked their way through 5 buses and without any assistance from the interstate highway systems. There were no fucking highways. You gotta be working on dirt roads at this point, too, in some of these places. Jesus.
God.
Despite the hectic schedule, on Monday, February 2nd, tour promoters inconsiderably booked a show in Clear Lake, Iowa that night, their only free date. Which is weird, because like you have 24 shows, 21 days, and you have a free day in there. Like
the math.
The math is ridiculous.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
All right. So here's their schedule. They're going on February 1st. They'll be in Green Bay, Wisconsin. They're going to drive 350 miles on February 2nd to be in Clear Lake, Iowa. They're going to drive 365 miles back, and on February 3rd, be in Moorhead, Minnesota. From there, they will drive 325 miles, and on February 4th, be in Sioux City, Iowa.
Back in Iowa.
Back in Iowa again. Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, Iowa again. That's fucking ridiculous.
Just make it one line.
In addition to this, this trip would also have them travel back through two towns they had already played at. Finally fed up, Buddy Holly booked a 1947 single-engine V-tailed Beechcraft Bonanza to Fargo, North Dakota.
Bonanza.
It was 1.5 miles and only 5 minutes from Morrishead. The most commonly accepted version of the events are as follows. Buddy Holly offered the two other seats on the plane to his remaining band members. The drummer Carl Bunch was still hospitalized. Well, Richie Valens, who had also had a fear of flying, for some reason wanted to fly. Do not go on a Beechcraft Bonanza if you have a fear of flying. Richie Valens actually won a coin toss for Tommy's seat, and the Big Bopper was still sick with the flu, was able to acquire Waylon Jennings' seat on the aircraft. To which Buddy Holly jokingly remarked, "Well, I hope your damn bus freezes up again." To which Waylon Jennings responded, "Well, I hope your old plane crashes."
Waylon.
It's kind of one of those things where it's just like, what if he's dead? And he was dead.
He's spoken into existence.
However, there was an alternative version of events from the mostly forgotten Dion Micucci, which was in where Holly had in fact approached the other three singers on tour to accompany the remaining two seats, as they were, quotes, the one making the money. In Dion's version of events, it was Richie Valens who still suffered from the flu. Don't know why that matters. And guaranteed the seat, the Big Bopper, and Dion flipped the coin for the remaining seat. Despite winning the coin toss, Dion ultimately decided to give up his seat and not wanting to indulge on the expensive $36 plane ticket, which would be $333.
Wait, so you're flipping for coins, but you still have to pay your own ticket?
Apparently, yeah.
That's fucking...
That's his version of events. That's the leastly accepted version of events. That's okay. Kind of like, which I assume Bob Odenkirk, or whatever fuck, not Bob Odenkirk, the Odin dude
Greg
from Larry.
Odom.
Yeah, I'm assuming his version will be less accepted, hopefully in the future as well.
Okay.
I think that's kind of what happened there. He's not as famous either, so I feel like people are just kind of like, who's that guy? Talking about Big
Celebrity
Bopper.
Celebrity culture wins again.
Exactly. Either way it happened, their last minute show in Clear Lake, Iowa, Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, JP, the Big Bopper, Richardson's, and their 21-year-old local pilot, Roger Peterson, all boarded the plane and took off on February 3rd at 12:55 a.m. When the plane took off, it was only slightly snowing, but it was still visible, visibility of 6 miles and winds between 20 and 30 miles per hour. The owner of the air service company, Jerry Dwyer, reported to have watched the aircraft from the flight tower take off and ascend 800 feet, turning 180 degrees around the airport into corrective turn towards the northwest heading, and then watched as the taillights slowly began to descend out of sight. They were out of radio contact within 5 minutes. Later that morning, Jerry Dwyer took off in search of them, and approximately 9:35 a.m., the wreckage of the plane was found only 6 short miles from the airport which it had left.
Wow.
It was estimated that the plane hit the ground with the impact of 170 miles an hour from a nosedive. The right wing tip had made contact with the ground first, flinging the aircraft into a cartwheel a further 540 feet across the frozen field, where it came to rest against a mere wire fence.
Wow.
It's a pretty crazy picture, just watching this huge crane, just the fire fence, just, I got it. all three musicians were thrown from the wreckage upon impact. Buddy Holly and Richie Valens were found closer to the wreckage, where the body of the Big Bopper had been thrown clear over the fence into the neighboring cornfield. That's pretty rough to find. The remains of Roger Peterson were entrapped in the airplane. While the young pilot had been described as having built his life around fat flying, Peterson was only allowed to operate under visible flying rules, very similar to what you were saying, Brianna.
Mm-hmm.
It was not qualified to fly solely on reference to instruments. Furthermore, Peterson had failed an instrument check ride 9 months prior to the incident, and the Bonanza in question was outfitted with an older model F3 altitude gyroscope instead of the more conventional artificial horizon on which he had been trained.
I looked into that. Did you look into that?
I was just going to say, an altitude gyroscope sounds very important.
So, yeah, that's like the old-fashioned thing you might see in the... It's like the
I imagine it's the thing that spins,
that rolls
yeah.
around. So yeah. that's the other thing, too. Yeah, exactly.
Sounds exactly what you think
And that's the
be.
New one, which so you might see on, like, GP... On,
oh, yeah, yeah, I've seen those before.
On, like, GTA, when you're flying the planes and you see a little thing over the top of your map, you get the same thing. That's the newer version of it. So not only had he failed the new version, he yeah. doesn't know how to do the fucking old one either.
So he's just not...
No, he's just
not
certified. He's eyeballing it.
The important thing about the old one is
a tit in the yard.
The sky, when you're going up, it points towards the blue, which is the sky. On this, it's the opposite.
Oh.
Climb is down here. If you're going up, it looks like
Holy
your horizon
shit, that's
is going
so
the
cool.
opposite way.
That sounds disorienting.
I really appreciate you researching that, because yeah. that explains a lot.
So he flies into the clouds. You know, flies into the snow, maybe it picks up.
Looks
maybe
down, he's like, why am I going down?
He's yeah, yeah. He yeah. tries to make a turn or whatever. All of a sudden, you're in a nosedive.
Yeah.
Graveyard wow. spiral strikes again.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I really appreciate
That's
that.
Very helpful.
Approximately 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks pregnant, Maria Ellen Holly, Buddy's wife of 6 months, had miscarried when she heard the news of her husband's death. Wow, that hit really hard in the next half. Maria even goes as far as to blame herself, seeing that she would have never let her husband go on the plane if she had been on tour with him as usual.
Girl, what could you have done?
She would have been on tour with him. She was pregnant. She stayed home. She
no, that makes sense.
To.
I'm not to be that person, but your wife's pregnant. Why are you touring?
to
I understand
money
you need
for
money,
her.
But...
He got...
Go get a job.
He's Buddy Holly, man.
Buddy Holly can work a fucking register because
his
wife
day,
is pregnant.
Things are getting closer. Rolling faster than a roller coaster, you think?
Maybe he'd survive if he worked a register.
Jesus. And yet, despite that all that ensued after 11 days on tour and after the death of all three of your major headliners, the Widder Dance Party Tour continued on, with then 15-year-old Bobby V sang for Holly on Monroe Head. The rest of the tour would continue with additional 2 weeks with Waylon Jennings filling in for Buddy Holly as the group singer, and thus Waylon Jennings' career skyrocketed.
They kept going.
Yeah.
And Waylon Jennings was the lone survivor.
Yeah, that is our story.
Wow, so two bad pilots, two bad bus drivers.
A lot of mistakes.
A lot of mechanical failures or...
A lot of people who should have just not been in the air.
I don't really have any advice, honestly, anymore. I thought I had a more concrete thing. It just sounds like everything's shitty. Buy a new plane, buy a new bus. I don't know.
Make sure you do your safety checks.
Yeah.
Buy enough fuel.
Check your fuel.
It seems to be safer to be in a bus, I'd say.
I'm just going to walk.
Yeah. You like the bus.
These days, the bus drivers are under a lot more strict hours. They're not allowed to drive for more than so many hours yeah. at a time. Yeah. They won't fall asleep, hopefully.
You hope.
Would hope. So yeah, that was our jank. That was a lot of fun. I appreciate everyone joining us.
That was intense.
Yeah, I know. I was having a lot of fun writing that, just trying to be very in the moment and very specific about things. So I had a lot of fun with that. Yeah. I think I want to do an Ozzy one next. Talk a little bit about his switch from Black Sabbath over to his solo career. I think that'd be kind of fun. Major Arc being like the bit the head off the bat story, how it started. We also got some recommendations from the questionnaire, one being the fascination with the 27 Club. I think I can work with something like that, which would be just kind of like what we were talking about, how the Wikipedia page has completely changed recently.
Yeah.
Where it was like any musician who died before 27, and now it is at 27 or around that date. So they actually simplified it a lot more, which will be interesting to see who got taken off the list because of that reason and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, I went to the History of Stringed Instruments in the VMFA.
Oh, yeah, that...
And they had a little bit about Lead Belly and stuff like that. They kind of talked about the blues.
Is that going on right now?
Is it still going on?
Is that a special I think it's, exhibit thing?
Yeah, it's really dope.
Jeez, I think it was towards the beginning of November.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's still going on now, but that was
dope. Let me double check, because we should let people know about it.
Yeah, we should. I got a lot of pictures of that, and I'm actually going to use it. A lot of that for like the basis at the beginning of my research.
It's on through March 19th.
Oh wow, is it
nice?
Really?
Wasn't it definitely like go to it. It was a great, great exhibit. Had a lot of fun.
So if you go to the VMFA,
it was the History of the Guitar in American Art.
Yes.
Okay.
They have like some original Martins in there that have some really crazy looking tuning mechanisms where like the I don't know how to describe it. It was really weird. Like, the peg goes through the headboard, and it's on the other fucking side. It's just really weird looking. Go see that. That's a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll use some of that for some other future things. Yeah, 27 Club. We would love to do a GWAR series as well if we can ever get our fucking hands on that book.
I love Selena's story, and I'd love to do an episode on her.
That would be pretty dope. A little more true crimey.
It is a little more true crimey.
But that's fine.
So, yeah, let us know what you want to hear.
And maybe we can do something. Please like and subscribe. Please follow us on Spotify. If you listen to us on Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts, and also give us 5 stars. If you follow us, you can listen to the episodes as they come out, as we do not always have art up when we put the episodes out. So maybe you can listen to it before other people. Thanks for joining us. I have been Cole.
I'm Brianna.
And I'm Zach.
Thanks. 2 things that I would like to mention that was overlooked during this episode. First, our honorable mentions, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and especially Otis Redding, unfortunately did not have a whole lot of exposition before or coverage of the crashes that took their lives. Seems like a lot of the articles I read would simply refer to fog as the cause with little more than a shrug. Second, being the argument made by Leonard Skinnerd bodyguard Gene Odom. What he was trying to say that the legal fault of the plane accident would ultimately have been the fault of the bands due to a contract they had signed. The argument he was trying to make was that if the pilots had been up all night doing cocaine, which they had not been, let's make that a fact, they had not been doing that, Gene was trying to say that if they had, it still would not have been their fault because of the contract signed by the bands. The band was the only one in legal control of that plane going up or down. And even though you would think you could trust your pilots and they know what they do, it was determined that the crucial moment of turning around to put them over top of that tree line could have legally been stopped by the members of the band. I don't know. All I can say is read your contracts, don't go flying in a Beechcraft Bonanza, or if it's extremely foggy. I really hope you enjoyed our extra spooky episode of River City Sounds Special History Episode 3 on aerial tragedies in the music community and Cliff Burton. Please be safe out there. Please like, subscribe, and follow us in all of the joints. You can find us at River City Sounds. Have a good one.